the big names are here. Ooh, who is that?
I think she was in the movie about that really big shark.
No, not her. The florist.
Oh, she's automating invoices on the go so she can spend more time on that flower wall.
QuickBooks can save you up to 8 hours a week so you could bring your vision to life. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks.
How you doing, Met fans? Welcome to another edition of the Terry Collins Show, presented by Tunnel the Towers, supporting America's greatest heroes. Donate just $11 per month by going to t2t.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. I'm John Arezzi, and joining me from his home on the Treasure Coast of Florida, the former skipper of the New York Mets, the current analyst for SNY's Baseball Night in New York, Mr. Terry Collins. Terry, welcome back for another show, and this one will be a special one.
This one's going to be a great show, John. Thanks. I'm looking forward to it. You know, we've got a special guest coming on today, one of my favorite people. And then when you listen to this guy talk, he's going to become one of yours, too. He's a special person. He was a special player, and it's Curtis Granderson. He means a lot to a lot of people, and what he's done off the field as well as on the field in baseball has been amazing.
Yeah, he's so beloved. I mean, when we announced on social media that Curtis was going to be a guest on this edition of the show, the response we got was unlike anything that we've had in the 14 previous shows that we've done. He's just universally beloved, and I can't wait to bring him on in just a short few minutes. But another one that you're another person that you're very fond of had a very special weekend. Major League Baseball inducted four new members into the Hall of Fame over the weekend. Adrian Beltre, Todd Helton, and Joe Mauer were the players who entered the hallowed halls of Cooperstown. The other inductee is a former manager and a very close personal friend of yours, Jim Leland. Talk to us about Leland, your friendship with him, and how it feels to see your friend inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Well, it was an absolute honor. I was so excited when his name was brought up in the beginning, you know, possibly going into the Hall of Fame. I called him and said, hey, listen, I just want you to know we're all rooting for you. And he said, I'm not going into the Hall of Fame. He said, I don't have enough wins and blah, 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 this and that. So sure enough, about 2 days later, phone rings. It's 9 o'clock at night. It's Jim. And he said, I'm going to the Hall of Fame. And tears were, I can hear, he was crying. He was so emotional about it. And I said, nobody deserves it more. And so I called him this week beforehand and just, again, wished him luck and told him I'm sure his speech was great, which I saw it. It was really, really good. But it's a special honor for, you know, for me to be associated with him. He was my mentor, taught me a lot about how to handle people, how to manage in the big leagues, how to deal with the media, which I thought was probably something I did pretty well. So it was all up. That was all because of Jim Leland. And I go back and, you know, we had similar careers. He grew up a Tiger in the minor leagues for a long time, managed a long time in the minor leagues and never could get to the big leagues as a coach when Sparky was there. So he ended up leaving and going with Tony La Russa to the White Sox. Well, I had a similar situation. I was with the Dodgers for many, many years, longtime AAA manager. Well, Tommy was there, Tommy Lasorda, and he wasn't going anywhere, and he wasn't going to bring me up as a coach, so I ended up leaving and going to Jim Leland and becoming one of his, going to the Pirates and with Jim Leland. So we had similar backgrounds, and it was an honor, and I'm so excited for it.
Yeah, it was a very emotional speech from Jim yesterday, and just so heartfelt, and it was just amazing. Congratulations to him, and I'm sure you're thrilled as well. For Jim Leland. Now on to the leadoff, Terry. The National League wildcard race is as tight as it's ever been as we record this. The Mets are actually in a three-way tie for the third spot, right alongside the San Diego Padres and defending National League champion Arizona Diamondbacks. And Terry, as a manager in a race as tight as this, and even though it's only the third week of July, how much pressure does it put on you as a manager, and how do you keep the team focused on playing one game at a time?
Well, certainly coming out of the break, I know Carlos probably had a meeting with his guys before the first game out of the break in Miami and saying, hey, look, you know, this is what we wanted going into the second half and with a chance to get to the playoffs. So now all of a sudden, you know, the motivation is every day coming to the ballpark and having and winning. That motivation, because you're looking at playoff spots right now that are hard to find. And that's one of the reasons why I really like that extra playoff spot to give, because it's now there's so many fan bases now they're still excited about what's going on. So come 2 weeks at the trading deadline that's coming up, you know what? Those teams are everybody's going to try to get better. So now all of a sudden it becomes very, very exciting and the players get excited. It's not hard to come to the park anymore. They're excited to go through those doors to get their work done, to get on that field and play. And that's all you can ask of being in those situations, especially late in the summer when it gets to be the dog. They call them the dog days for a reason. Everybody's getting tired. It's hot, you know, but I'll tell you what's special is when you come in there knowing that you've got a chance to be in the playoffs.
Yeah. And it's so many teams, like there's still 8-9 teams that are still really viable playoff contenders for that wild card. The Mets are only 4 games from the first wild card spot, and this weekend they'll return home to play a 4-game series against the team that's in that first spot, the Atlanta Braves. And the Braves are really getting hammered right now on the injury front. So this weekend's going to be pretty exciting. It's also the series that Kodai Senga is scheduled to return to the Mets and pitch finally in the 2024 season. So Terry, this seems to be shaping up as the biggest series of the season for the Mets. And do now they need to make a statement against their Southern rivals, the Atlanta Braves, who are having their own problems on the injury front?
Yes, John, I'm looking at the entire week now. You've got 2 against the Yankees and 4 against the Braves. Those are big games. Yankees are trying to get back on track. You're playing them at Yankee Stadium where they're so dangerous. So, and then you've got 4 against the Braves where you can win. Let's just say you win 3 out of 4. You know, bingo, you're right on barking on their heels now. So I think it's a huge series. And by the way, you know, I have Brian Snitker, the manager of the Braves, a very good friend of mine. Let me tell you something. I've been in that spot. Nobody feels sorry for you. Nobody feels sorry for the fact that Albies is down, Acuna's down, Max Fried's down now. Nobody feels sorry for it. This is the big leagues. And this is when you get a chance to beat somebody up who's really, really good. When things are bad, you take that chance. And you go out and you win those games, and it makes a statement. So I'm excited to see how the rest of this week fills out for those guys.
Yeah, it's going to be a big week for the Mets. Of course, as you mentioned, they head cross town to Yankee Stadium to play the away portion of the Subway Series in a 2-game set. The Mets swept their home portion of the series, beating the Bronx Bombers in the 2 games played at Citi Field last month. The 2025 schedule was released last week, and the Subway Series will now expand to 6 games once again, 3 at Yankee Stadium in May of 2025, and then 3 games at Citi Field over the July 4th weekend next year. Your thoughts on bringing the Subway Series back to a 6-game format next year?
I think it's great. I think, you know what, this is, especially in that baseball crazy city, you know, to play 6 games against each other, it just creates so much excitement in the town, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Those are going to be big games next year. So, and you know, a few number of years ago when you played interleague, you did play a few more games than just the 4. So, it's going to change, but I think it's a great move, you know, especially in a lot of these crosstown rivalries that have it. I think it's going to create some interest.
Yeah. And Major League Baseball is doing an initiative they called Rivals Week, which will kick off, these, inner city rivals in that first series in May of next year. So it's great. And of course, the Subway Series was at one time 6 games a year. The fact that they're going back to 6 games a year, it's great for the fans, as you mentioned. And of course, you were in the dugout as skipper for many Subway Series. And I wanted to ask you what your most memorable moment managing the Mets during your time as skipper that took place in the Subway Series.
Well, all the years we had the Subway Series, there are certain games. I remember one of the games where, you know, we beat Mariano Rivera on, David Wright got a base hit and won the game. I'd been ejected in the 6th inning, but that was a big game. But I remember when we swept the Yankees. It was 4 games. It was 2-2, and we swept the Yankees. It was 4 days in a row, 2 at Citi Field, 2 at Yankee Stadium. And I walked in the media room afterwards, and you know, and by the way, when you played the Yankees in the Subway Series, it was like a World Series game. There was 15 TV cameras and 30 or 40 reporters outside. There were like five reporters left in the room when I walked in the room after sweeping them. Everybody else was going in to see what was going to happen because we just swept the Yankees. And all the reporters are saying, oh, George is rolling over in his grave right now. And, oh, my God, all hell's going to break loose. So that I remember that distinctly. I walked in, and there's like, where'd everybody go? I had my five beat guys. That was the only ones left in the room. So I remember that specifically. I was pretty happy with that.
Yeah, a sweep is always great. And, of course, the Mets have the opportunity this week. We'll see what happens at Yankee Stadium. A big week for the Mets. All right, Terry, let's take a look and go back at this week in Mets history. On July 19, 2015, in an 18-inning marathon, the Mets defeat the St. Louis Cardinals 3-1 on the road. And despite going 1-for-26 with runners in scoring position, leaving 25 men on base, the Mets secured the W after starter Jonathan Neese and the bullpen combined to throw 18 innings of one-run ball. Terry, what memories do you have of that game?
Well, you know, after about 12 innings, it's almost like you just want to get the game over. You could just sense that feeling like, let's just get it over with. But I'll tell you what, that just goes back to tell you what it was like in 2015. These guys were going to win that game. They were bound and determined. They didn't care how long it went. We were going to win the game. You could just sense, you know, there was a bats meant something, and guys were trying to figure out how to, you know, they were talking about the pitchers coming in and what they had, what to expect. And we're, you know, hey, look, let's go the other way a little bit more. Let's get the ball, get deeper in the zone. I mean, they were really focused on the game. And, you know, of course, our bullpen did an absolutely brilliant job in that game.
Well, with the rule changes and now a runner starts off on second base to begin in extra innings, it's kind of unlikely that we'll see a game ever go this long again. What's your feeling on the ghost runner in extra inning games today?
I don't even watch it, John. I watch games, and if it goes extra innings, I turn it off.
That's it.
You know, I watched a game. This is a true story. I watched a game last year. And the ghost runner went out to second base. Obviously, he's the guy who made the last out the inning before in the ninth inning. This guy had struck out four times in the game. Four times. And now he's on second base. Somebody gets a hit. He scores the win. He scores the run. And everybody's high-fiving him and, hey, nice going, nice going. This guy hasn't been on the base the entire game. And now he's a hero. I mean, I think one thing about baseball, it's nice because you play both sides of the ball except for the DH. So you can help win a game on either side. But I just don't, you know, there's a guy out there, you know, I can just imagine when this first happened, I thought, you know, can you imagine being Jake DeGrom, throwing nine innings, one hit, you know, 14 strikeouts, and then, you know, you got 92 pitches. And so they go, hey, look, go out and pitch the 10th inning. You still got something left. And you got a runner at second base that doesn't deserve to be there. And somebody hits a pop-up or get him to third and a jam shot, broken bat over the first baseman, then you lose the game. I don't like it. I don't like it. I think maybe, you know, John, after 14 innings, put a runner out there, but that's hard to put a nail up on your, next to one of those guys' names that, you know, shouldn't be up there.
Yeah, so. I agree with you. I mean, I don't like that ghost runner. I mean, it just took away from the tradition of the game. I remember some games. I remember a game in 1968, where it was a 24-inning game, and I'm a kid, and I'm listening on the radio, and it's the Mets against the Astros, and it was 24 innings, and I was up until like 3-4 in the morning as a kid. The Mets lost the game, but those long marathons are, you know, they're just historic in a lot of ways, the way some of them go. But now you put a guy on second base. I really wish Major League Baseball would reconsider that and take away that ghost runner and take it back to the way the game used to be played. But Terry, going back to history, special day, July 21st, 2004, David Wright makes his Major League debut against the Expos at Shea Stadium. And before his call-up that year, the 21-year-old was hitting .341 with 18 home runs in 91 games between Binghamton and Norfolk. Terry, talk about how important David was to you as the New York Mets manager in 2011 when you started, and his importance to you today.
Well, I'll tell you, the first time I met David Wright, John, I had just come back from Japan, and Omar Minaya had hired me to be the field coordinator and basically run the on-the-field operations for the minor leagues. And so I came down to Florida early because we open up our camp in January to guys who want to work out. And I went out to dinner that night, and who walks up to me but David Wright? And I have never met David Wright. He walks up and sits down. And he said, "Hey, I just want to introduce myself. I'm David Wright." And he said, "I saw you sitting over here. I just want to come over and talk." And so we struck up a conversation. We talked for about an hour, never met the guy, talked to him for an hour. The next year, I'm the manager of the team. The first call I get from a player was from David Wright and how excited he was. And we just got a friendship together that not only was he a great player, but he, as I've told you so many times, just a great person and respectful of the game itself. And that's why I've always thought one thing I did, I respected the game of baseball, and David Wright personified it as a star. And even and so just to have him around, when I left in 2017, the first guy who called me and I retired was David Wright. And those that just tell you what he means to me. I mean, his kindness, his friendship, you know, I certainly respect it and really enjoy. I enjoy any time I'm around him. We have a great time, laugh and talk about stuff, but he just, his love of the game and who he was is special to me.
Thanks, Terry. You can check out Mets history every day by going to @NYMHistory on X. And now it's time for this week's Talkin' with TC. Today on Talkin' with TC, our guest is one of the all-time favorites of Met fans. He was a part of the 2015 National League Championship team, where along with Daniel Murphy, was one of the most productive hitters in the lineup in the postseason that year. He played for the Mets from 2014 to 2017. Other stops in his illustrious career were stints with the Detroit Tigers, New York Yankees, Los Angeles Dodgers, Toronto Blue Jays, Milwaukee Brewers, and Miami Marlins. He's a three-time All-Star, a Silver Slugger Award winner, a recipient of the Roberto Clemente Award in 2016, and has been named the Marvin Miller Man of the Year four times. He's also worked as a baseball analyst for TBS. His ongoing mission with the Curtis Granderson Foundation has benefited inner city children in Chicago and other cities as well. And he's a board chair for the Baseball Players Alliance. What a resume. It is our pleasure to welcome Curtis Granderson to the Terry Collins Show. Curtis, welcome to Talking with TC.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And thanks for that introduction.
Well, you deserved it, Curtis. Thanks for coming on today. And, you know, we're just going to have some fun talking about some times. You know, of course, every time I do these shows, Curtis, or I go out, everybody, you know, they always ask me about, you know, what it was like in 2015. That was all these Mets fans, you know, that's all they can remember pretty much of all the whole time I was with New York. So, you know, I always ask anybody who was on those teams. It can't. Matter of fact, we had Sandy Alderson on the show one time where I asked him. So, you know, during 2015, all of a sudden we started making deals. What was, as a player on the team, tell us, what was your thought process as we brought in all of a sudden Kelly Johnson and Uribe and the pitching, and then finally Cespedes? I mean, what were you guys thinking in that clubhouse at that time?
I think there's two things to it, because when you hear the trade deadline, everyone's expecting, this big name is going to come, but you also don't want to lose pieces because we have been clicking. We have been playing well. So you get double nickels over there with Kelly Johnson wearing 55 and Juan Uribe in that just rock hard belly of his that can just hit you out but play anywhere. So those two pieces were amazing. And TC, I don't know if you remember this because you might have still been inside, but the trade deadline ended at 4 o'clock and we're outside for stretch at say 4:05. Nothing happens. So we're like, all right, let's just walk on the field and get ready to get our stretch done. This is the team we have. This is the team we're going to finish 2015 with. It's solid. Let's go. And as soon as we got on the field for stretch, that's when the rumor started to break about the Cespedes trade. And we're like, is it true? Is it not? Because the deadline has passed. But you know how this works in the game. Stuff is still rolling in. It's still being confirmed. It's still being announced. But we as the players, we didn't know. We got a game to play that night. And then boom. Cespedes gets announced and we're like, oh man. And then now you add in with everything else we have going on. And plus the big thing is he came in and clicked. You know, sometimes you get a name that comes in and it just doesn't, it's not the right piece. And he was the perfect piece to that puzzle that we definitely needed. So it was amazing how it all went down. Talk about suspense, talk about excitement, and then boom, the roller coaster just kept going.
You know, Curtis, in all your career, I mean, you were in a lot of, especially late in the season at those trading deadlines, you were in a lot of clubs that, you know, were headed for the playoffs. I mean, you good teams. And so was this a different situation? I mean, I talked to Sandy about it, I said, you know, I asked him, you know, at what time during the first part of that season did you guys say, hey, look, if we had a couple pieces, we got a chance here. Did you guys always think that was the same in that clubhouse? Were you guys saying, you know, if we get a couple pieces here, we got a chance to win this thing?
You know what? It's funny because we started out so well. We were hot. We were rocking. The crowd was amazing. And then we were traveling well on the road. And you started seeing the seven line and the blue and the orange just coming not only in the hotels, but in the stadiums around the towns. So you were sensitive and feeling it. But we felt like what we had was solid. Not saying that we were set. We would have loved to have pieces, but we didn't think of any of the pieces that Sandy brought in as, okay, yeah, we're missing a Clipper, we're missing a Reed, we're missing a Uribe, we're missing a Kelly Johnson, and of course a Cespedes. I think you're just so into the moment of the season and just continuing to go that every day until they tell you something, that's when you start to think about it. So it never crossed my mind, like, and your door was always open. We never came to talk to you and said, hey, TC, you know, we're missing something. We got to get this piece or this piece. And same thing with Sandy. You know, it was never a topic of conversation. We were just out there one day at a time, one series at a time, having a ton of fun. And for everyone that watched, I mean, we were always having a good time. But you can have a good time when you're prepared and you're also going out there and doing what you're supposed to do. That's what we did. We focused on what we needed to focus on and didn't necessarily think about those pieces until the deadline day, because we knew we were in it and we knew something was going to happen. So we just wanted to know what it was going to be. We just had no idea. Did we need a position player? Did we need a pitcher? Did we need a reliever? We were just like, all right, something's going to happen. Just what is it going to be?
Yeah. You know, I tell everybody, yeah, especially people who, you know, they think players don't pay attention. You know, I said, look, don't ever think players are naive. They know exactly what's going on. They listen. I said, matter of fact, half the rumors get started by players talking because, you know, they have this time on their hands before a game where, hey, there's conversations about the game itself going on or maybe a trade someone else made. You know, so I say, you know, I think you guys get a bad rap sometimes by, oh, they don't care about anything else except their own selves. And that's not true. That is, I mean, all good teams I've ever been on, I'm telling you, there's conversation, baseball conversation going on daily.
Yeah, we're definitely not in the point where it's not, we don't care. It's just that, you know, our focus is on try to control as much as you can. Because I remember being rumored in a trade early in my career and it kind of got to me a little bit like, oh, am I going to go? Am I not? And then nothing happened. So I stepped back and said, all right, unless something happens, I'm not going to focus on it too much. I know that those things end up going on throughout the course of the game and we're seeing and we're watching, especially with players that are represented by agencies that have other players on other teams. So there's conversations that are happening. And now, which is, you know, almost 10 years removed from 2015, with social media, with friends and family all on it, anything that pops and your name is associated to it, even if you're not trying to look at it, someone's calling you up. Hey, did you hear this? Is it true? Someone's sending you a text, someone's sending you a tweet, someone's sending you a DM. So you try to avoid it, but it's all around you. At least back then, you could kind of like not look at the paper. You could turn the TV off and you might be a little bit shielded from it, but it's tough right now. So even if you want to stay away from it, you can't.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, Curtis, as I look back and some of the things you did, one of the things that you did that I'm telling you that, I look at the special teams today and it happens. You played every day. I mean, I look, you, how many, there was like, I mean, maybe 8 years. You played 160 games in a year. Did you, I mean, I remember I remember going up to you and saying, hey, do you need a day this week? Hey, I'll get you a day this week. And you being yourself just said, well, you know, I'll be fine. If you want to give me a day, give me a day. You're the manager. But I mean, you went out there, man, 160, that's a lot of games.
Hey, that's the way I looked at it. You're the one in charge. You were the manager and a great manager. So you tell us, unless there's something like I'm ailing really bad, then I'll say something. But again, that's very rare. And I found later in my career how to go at 100%, how to pull back just enough not to damage anything, but to still give you everything that you need and what the fans expect. But you did something that I still remember to this day, and I tell so many young players about it. I had like a little calf or something going on, and you and I were trying to figure out the plan. Hey, do we take a day? Do we take 2 days or three, whatever the case is going to be? So we missed the first day. And then the second day, I said, I think I'm good to go. And you said, no, I'm going to give you one more day. I'd rather you miss one day than me put you out there. You blow out and I'm missing you for 2 or 3 weeks. So even those little things, although I played all the time, I knew, okay, I just need to pull back today. And then I can give you another 20 days in a row. But if I keep pushing, keep pushing, keep pushing, I'm not going to make it to the 20. And that was all part of you. So I'm not sure if I ever got a chance to credit you and thank you for that. But I remember us having that conversation, and I tell so many young players about it. Even when you feel great, you might just need one more day. And that one more day can get you through everything. Don't push through it, and then all of a sudden we're missing you for a period of time. And that was the part, and I think the keys that allowed me the opportunity to get to the 160s. I may need a day. I may need just a couple innings. Whatever the case it is, just give me just that, and then I can give you everything else.
Curtis, you know, you played all three outfield positions. Was there one that you said, boy, this is where I'd like to play? Or did you just say, hey, I moved you to right field, and you said, I'm going to go play right field? Was it no big deal, or was there, did you say, man, I wish I could back in center field? I mean, I know we got you, you played you in center. One spot you really liked more than the others?
You know, I started my career when I got drafted and left, and then really learned that and really enjoyed it, then ended up in center, made it to the big leagues in center. And then I think the first time I was officially in right was with the Mets. But I had played right in college, and I think right field is the easiest one to play. So when you put me out there, I was like, yeah, I hadn't been there in a while, but this kind of felt like second nature. So I was good out there. Plus, our dugout was on first base, so it was a little like short jog out there. So I like that side.
Yeah. But well, you know, I'm telling you, I've told a lot of people playing right field in Citi Field, that place is tough in right field. Yeah. You know, they got that overhang,
bump outs, and the moving and everything. But the one thing I felt like, especially with Tom Goodwin, you know, he was so good. We got our work in out there. I just knew exactly where I needed to be to help make that as easy as it could be. Of course, still challenging, but this. We always worked. If I was playing or not playing, I definitely went out there and got my fly balls and ground balls, and I wanted to see the work. And then, especially with the number of right-handed hitters in batting practice, they would always work to right field. So I got a lot of balls out there just to see throughout the course of the game. So that made it comfortable out there. And then as we started to transition to, hey, you're going back to center, there'd be times I'm like, I'm the oldest guy on this team. How come I'm playing center field? There's some fresh legs over here. But I loved it. It was great because I had everything in front of me, and the corner outfielders, no matter who it was, whether it was Cespedes or Conforto or Deaza, whoever it happened to be, I just had to move them one way or the other, and they listened. So I was like, all right, you move this way, you move this way. Let's blanket this as best as we can, move in, move back. But they also, I gave them respect. So if they saw something, move me. Hey, if I'm too shallow, if I'm too deep, let me know. And I was never going to say, you know, stop talking, even although I'm the oldest one out here. I want to hear whatever information can make me better. And hopefully you respect whatever I'm going to give you to make you better. So I had fun out there. So whichever one you happen to put me into, it was always a good time. But then on the flip, as the career got later, when I went back to left, I felt lost a little bit. It's like,
no kidding.
I was out there. I was like, I hadn't been here in a little bit. Hit it to me and during this time of the game when we're up a lot or down a lot. So hopefully I don't mess this thing up. So I never said that because obviously I couldn't let anybody know. But there were times out there I was like, please don't hit it to me. Please.
I mean, when you went to Miami, were you in left field at that time? Because that's a tough left field.
Yeah. So I had to get back out there. And going prior to that, when I was in Toronto, Devon White was key. So I said, hey, I haven't been out in left in a while. He's like, all right, let's get out there. Let's go out there and let's make this, you know, less of a liability and more of a strength. So that helped me to make it more comfortable because he was great at pushing me out there. Tom Goodwin was great at pushing me out there. And the reason I played center at the level I did was Andy Van Slyke with Detroit. they all just kept pushing in that spot. And I said, let's go. We got to get as good as we can out there. And those three were very key in my career throughout being the outfielder that I was.
Wow. I didn't know you had Andy in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. He was out there running us crazy out there. He would do drills. They'd have to pull him back and say, hey, you know, we're going to blow out these guys. I mean, he had us running and running and running. But that's how he learned. That's why he was so good. So we did as much of it as we could until the trainer stopped it. But that's why I was able to play center field in Detroit, because my scouting report, if anyone finds it, says that I was not fast enough to play center field, especially in Detroit. And that's where I played a majority of my center field. But that was because of Andy Van Slyke.
Wow, that's cool. You know, I was in Pittsburgh when Andy was Andy. They just got to the Pirates, and I saw Bill Verdon do that stuff with those guys. I mean, at the end of the day, he ran those guys in the ground going after balls. But, you know, again, I forgot about Andy being out there because they all got better. Even Barry got better. Bobby Bonilla got better, all because of those drills they did before. So,
and if you remember, like, if you had a spring training game and you weren't playing, that was a great day. You just took batting practice, took a couple fly balls, then you were done. Andy said, you wanted to play. You did not want to stay back, because if you stayed back, that's when you got crushed. And sure enough, Andy had the same mentality. So I was hoping I was playing. 3-hour bus ride, I didn't care. Let me go on the road. But those days I stayed back, that's what got me better.
Wow. You know, today, Randy, you watch guys today. I mean, they're very few guys. I mean, I talked like, you know, last year the Braves had like four guys that played 160 games. And that's, you know, with Lindor and Pete, they play a lot of games. I mean, I'm shocked today that, you know, there's not more guys that play 155, 160 games. You know, I think the training staff is so concerned about these guys due to being overworked that, you know, they think that's leading to injury. But, you know, you didn't have very many injuries.
No, you know, I got hit by pitches, which is something out of my control. So that happened to me twice one year right before I came over to the Mets. But, you know, the time we were there, like I said, I had a little calf thing here. I think I had maybe a little hammy thing, but I was like, all right, I understand what's going on. Let's talk. Let's get a plan. Let's not push through it. But listening to the body, understanding when I needed to hydrate, when I needed to pull back, when I could go full board in the weight room, when I had to pull back. So that's where I feel like just the transparency and the communication was such a key thing. And what we did a really good job with that Mets organization at that time is there was just a lot of talking. And I would come in, let them know how I felt. They would tell me what I'd feel. If I was supposed to do 5 sets of workout today, I said, hey, can we do 3? I still did the work. I didn't shy away from it. But, hey, let's pull back. Or, hey, I'm feeling really good. Let's go a little bit more. And it was those little things, I think, that just helped. But you can't just keep going like every day is the first day of spring training, especially when it's June and July and August and you've played 80, 90, 100 games. I can't lift like I was doing on day one. I have to modify it. So that means lower the weights, lower the reps, lower the number of swings, lower the number of ground balls. We get a good off day. We come back from the All-Star break. Now we can start to ramp up and add in. But if you just keep going and going and going, it's like the example they give with the car. I mean, I can keep flooring it, but eventually I'm going to run out of gas, plain and simple. And it's the same thing with the body. You just can't keep pushing it. So I think there's that balance of give and take on wondering how you can keep going and keep coasting, still stay ready. And I think that's one of the challenges. A lot of players don't think they're ready if they don't do everything every day. At this point in time, especially come like October, if I haven't figured it out by now, it's too late, you know. So, you know, I'm not going to get it done today. Yeah. You know, I got to keep going and going all the previous stuff. And if you think about just adding the number of swings, TC, if we're in the cage, I take my rounds off the tee. I take my soft toss. I may hit off the machine. Then we come out for the field and we do our 5 to 6 rounds of the batting practice. And I do that every day. By the time we get to June and July, I'm over thousands of swings. It's okay to miss 10. It's okay to miss 20 at this point in time, but I'm still going to get my work in. And you saw it towards the end. Sometimes I would just take BP in the cage.
Right.
I don't need to come on the field and hit at this point in time.
Right.
I'm gonna take my fly balls, and then I'm going to come off, rest up. And I think those things help me out a lot.
Yeah, I always thought, you know, especially a veteran guy, he knows how to keep himself ready and what he needs to do. I mean, especially at the end of summers, you know, you have batting practice because – some guys like to take batting practice. Like you didn't. There was a time, I think I can't remember if it was 15 or 16. You know, Seth, for the last month, he just hit inside. He didn't hit on the field anymore. You know, so I think you got to know yourself a little bit, and you know, go from there. And that's why, you know, that's why to have veteran leadership in the clubhouse, it helps some of these young guys, because all they, you know, they want to work and work and work. So they're showing everybody, hey, look, I'm working hard so I can keep playing. When you're right, and once in a while, you got to back off a little bit.
It's okay. Rest is part of the success. Right? We strength, we eat, we train, we do all that stuff, but rest is also one of those big key components. So adding that side to it is okay. And Cespedes is one of the best. He worked all the time, but when it was time for him to rest, he rested with the best of them. Remember that game that we had where he did the pinch hit home run? I think he was on the massage table when you were asking him to come into the game. I tell that story all the time.
He didn't even have his uniform on anymore. He had his gym shorts, and I said, Pat Ressler, and I said, get Seth ready. And he came back out. He goes, he's in his gym shorts and t-shirt. I said, okay. And he walks up and hits a homer. I mean, that was him.
That's his name. Remember, he's taping his wrist still? And it's like, what are we going to do here? He hasn't even swung the bat yet today. Then he comes up and boom, hits the home run. The crowd goes nuts. It's crazy. But he had been putting miles and miles prior to. So this isn't, hey, I haven't done this every day. I've been putting my work in. Today is one of those days where, hey, I'm not in the lineup. I'm going to take the game flowed and shifted where all of a sudden we needed him, but he's ready. The car has been running. The engine has been on. So that's why he was able to come in and do that stuff. And that's the part where people miss, like, oh, he doesn't do work. He's doing the work. Just because you don't always see it all the time doesn't mean that he's not doing the work.
Right.
He worked. I mean, he's probably the last true five-tool player that I have seen in person. When he'd run into run, he was the fastest individual I saw. The best arm. His BP power was amazing. I mean, he was going third deck at Citi Field. Hit for average, and he has a gold glove. So he was able to put it all together, but that's because of the work. He was my throwing partner. That's why we were able to throw so well, because I was throwing with Cespedes. That's how my arm improved a little bit, because I hadn't had a solid throwing partner in a while. So to get Cespedes back there was great for me.
Yeah, you guys, I mean, that's, you know, those are great. And that's, so you, do you watch a lot of games today? Curtis, you watch a lot of baseball today?
I don't watch from start to finish. So I do a lot of the highlights, or, you know, just see an alert pop in and I'll be like, okay. Oh, wow, this is crazy. Let me see this great play or something like that. So start to finish has been tough for me to do just because I'm always moving and going. And then, for example, I think this Tuesday we actually, or this upcoming broadcast that we have, I think is Yankees Mets. So I'll catch up a little bit with what's going on there, see what's happening. Of course, when we do our broadcast for the game, I'll obviously be watching that. But even still, just big moments are a lot of the stuff that I like to focus on.
So how much TV stuff are you doing these days?
So every Tuesday I'm in Atlanta broadcasting for TBS. We have our game of the week. Then come the postseason, we'll cover the division series and the championship series. And we alternate leagues. This year we have the American League. And then I'm done. So I just sit back and get a chance to be a fan for the World Series and spring training. And Players Alliance keeps me busy moving around a lot of stuff like that. And we actually just hosted a RBI regional tournament in Chicago at my stadium at UIC. So we had the Minnesota RBI, Gary, Indiana, Indianapolis, both Chicago Cubs and White Sox RBI teams there. And that was softball, 16U and 18U baseball. So I'm always around it. So like I said, I'm never watching from start to finish, but I'm always around it in some form or fashion.
Do you enjoy the game today with the new rules and everything involved?
I've always, you know, I like to stir the pot. You know, I always like a little bit of the change and things that are going on. So, you know, one of the things that from the bases, you know, being bigger and the stolen bases and the pickoff moves, I understood why they were wanting to do it. Like, people like seeing stolen bases. And sure enough, you saw it increase last year. But, you know, as this game has come very analytical and everything is very focused on the projected outcome, we see that teams don't want their players to steal because the risk of you getting thrown out takes away from that player possibly hitting a home run and that being a 2 or 3 run home run. So sure enough, we had Acuna steal 70 bases last year, and his projections for this year, they had already dropped him down to 50. So 20 less stolen bases. Did we think Acuna was going to be slower? Are we going to think he didn't want to run? I think they know and said, hey, we know teams, as much as we're emphasizing running, they're just not going to run at the volume that they do because the value of it just isn't there. So I love seeing players run. I think it puts pressure on not only the defense, but the pitching staff. You have to change your game with the runner on first, then with the runner on second, then with the runner on third. And that's that element that I don't think that some of the analytics can quantify. True, I'd love to have as many runners on the bases as I can when we hit a home run. But I think when you're running and you're thinking about it, that makes my job a little bit easier at the plate. When a pitcher has to eliminate a pitch, has to be a little bit quicker to the plate, might end up leaving the ball up a little bit more than it should be, might not have as much movement. It's those types of things that I enjoy. So I like that. I've enjoyed that the game is a little bit quicker. I mean, no one wants to be out there for 4 hours. I mean, that's right. Too late. You know, so I don't like that side of it. You know, especially when we're starting at 7 o'clock, it's 11 o'clock. We're trying to get home. Unless you're in New York, you know, we can get something to eat all the time. So I'm good with that. But, you know, those late, late games and with the follow-up by travel that I never loved. Let's see. Oh, but the biggest rule that I enjoyed, and I've been talking about this for the longest, is everybody plays everybody now. 162 games. It always just boggled my mind that we didn't play against everybody. So if you wanted to grow the game organically, what better way to do it than to have Shohei Ohtani and the Dodgers come play against the Texas Rangers, or, you know, have Mike Trout and the Anaheim Angels go play against the Milwaukee Brewers. I mean, I think it was last year or 2 years ago when Aaron Judge broke the home run record. It was the first time in 6 years that the Yankees had been in Milwaukee. So just think about that from a fan standpoint. That team 6 years ago was completely different than the team it is now. So the fact that I can visually see my team and the opponents, the ones that I've heard about and the ones that I've watched in my own backyard, on my station, on my app that I follow, I think just naturally helps grow the game. So I'm really excited about that one.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty funny you bring that up. In my 7 years managing the Mets, we played the Red Sox twice, never played them in Boston.
Right.
You know, we had interleague games and we played them in New York. Well, yep. We never went to Boston. So, you know, even some of our guys, you know, you've been in the American League, but there are some guys that, you know, had not been that in the American League that never played in Boston, had no idea what it was like to play in Fenway Park.
And think, I mean, the 7 line, I give them a ton of credit. They travel with the best of them. I mean, one of the most iconic moments was being in San Diego when Bartolo hits the home run and that one section in San Diego is going nuts. But they travel so well and we're so geographically close to the Red Sox. So if the Mets would have gone down to Fenway, that just would have been a great series for everybody, yeah, for baseball, yeah, for the fans, for whatever it happens, you know, regardless of the standings. That's the way I kind of see it from that side. If you want to grow the game, it's great to see everybody play. You know, being from Chicago, Michael Jordan was the man, plain and simple. Imagine if Michael Jordan didn't come play the Knicks in Madison Square Garden. Like, yeah, that would be a catastrophe. So I love the fact that we finally get a chance to see everybody play.
That's cool. So, John, I know you've got some Curtis Granderson questions you want to ask.
Yes, thanks, Terry. Appreciate it very much. Curtis, the Mets signed you to a 4-year free agent contract prior to the 2014 season, following your 4 years with the Yankees. What was it like for you to play for both New York teams? Compare the similarities and the differences between the Mets and the Yankee fans.
My one regret is I wish I would have bought something in New York. If I'd have known I'd have been there for 8 years, I would have had some real estate, but I didn't know I was going to be there that long. Even with the Yankees, I was there with 3 years left on my deal and a team option, which they then picked up. Then I become a free agent, and you just never know what free agency is going to unfold. I had no idea that the Mets would be in the mix until free agency happened. And then it was in the mix, and I met with Sandy, and everything started to move real quick, and boom, now I'm with the Mets. And ironically, as soon as I sign and I come do my physical at HSS, because I stayed near there, I stayed at 72nd and York, I left my physical, ran to my old apartment and asked if it was available for the next year, and started the process of signing my lease for the next year. And that's just how everything was so conveniently located. So from that side of it, it was so cool. From the Yankee fan base, I was there for the final four, or the big four wrapping up their careers with Jeter and Pettit and Posada and Rivera. So the treatment that we received just traveling nationwide was so cool, and going in Serrano, because people wanted to see them for their last games and for their last hurrahs. They had been there for all those championships. So that side of it was just so unique and so awesome to see. Now you fast forward and come over to the Mets. And again, kind of like the, what we just talked about, I didn't play in Shea Stadium. I never played there throughout the course of my career. And the only time I played the Mets was once in 2007. They came to the Tigers in interleague play, and then during the Subway Series with the Yankees. So we focused on that series, and then we were on to the AL East or the AL Central. So I didn't know much about the Mets prior to. So as we get in, and 14 was, you know, an average season. I think we finished 500, got a slow start, finished hot at the end, but wasn't enough to do anything. Then 15 happens and we start rolling. And then all of a sudden this energy came like something I had never seen. Like, it was just loud. It was intense. The fans were on the road. They were taking over the road cities. I mean, you'd see just blue and orange around the hotel, around the restaurants. I was like, this is intense. It's insane, but it's awesome at the same time. So from that side of it, it started to mirror what I had seen from the Yankees, just traveling fan bases that wanted to be there to support, that were loud and proud to let you know that they were a Yankee or a Mets fan. And we had success on both sides. So from that side of it, it was so cool. And the biggest thing that I tell everybody, if you want to hear the loudest boos ever, Citi Field. But if you also want to hear the loudest cheers, also Citi Field. Like, and I've been booed at Citi Field. My 14 didn't start off great. They come at you, and probably one of the biggest boos that we ever heard was when they announced Chase Utley in the NLDS. Woo! That was intense. And if you remember, TC, they did the player introductions, and they showed, I think it was Kershaw, and then it was Jimmy Rollins, and then they put the camera on Chase Utley, and they kept it on him. And they didn't move. Like, you got to move the camera. You got to get it off of them. And then we played into it. We had Ruben Tejada come out there with the cane and limp out there.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
All that stuff was just crazy to see firsthand. But on that side of it, they rocked when the place was great. But when they were ready to boo, they came down with the hammer on you over there with Citi Field. And I think that's what makes it so exciting on both places.
Yeah, I was at that playoff series in New York, and they left that graphic. They left that shot of Utley up a really, really long time, and he got an earful for sure. That was very, very exciting. But this question's for both of you. Curtis, when you came to the Mets, obviously Terry Collins was going to be your skipper. And Terry, you were getting a leader. You were getting an amazing player to be part of your team. Curtis, first to you, then to Terry. What did Terry Collins mean to you as skipper of the Mets? And give us your best Terry Collins story. And then, Terry, please respond with your memories of Curtis Granderson and what your reaction was when the Mets signed him. Curtis first.
So my first time meeting Terry was at the winter meetings. We were up in a suite in Orlando. So I come in there, and there's a few other individuals, finally getting a chance to meet, excited. And then we go out there, do the press conference, and then we leave. So I don't see TC until spring training, just because just the way the flow of the offseason goes. So we get to spring training, and he's coming up to you and talking to you and asking, okay, what do you want to do for spring training? What do you want for your bats? What do you want for your games? How many innings do you want? So on and so on. So we're just having those conversations, which I enjoy. I mean, I take it for granted, but a lot of times people just don't talk throughout the baseball world for whatever reason. But he was always talking, and even as games would unfold, I would start to move down in the locker or in the dugout and just be closer towards, you know, all the coaching staff and kind of joke with them a little bit, talk with them, hear what they're talking about and seeing as the flow of the game's going on, and then come back. And then two funny stories with TC. The first one is when we get Tebow. So Tebow comes and joins us, and TC comes to me and goes, look, if there is a ball between the two of you, do not run into him because you are not going to win. And Tebow was just shredded. I mean, he was just such a just solid specimen. So I took that lesson for sure. I was not running into TC.
No.
And then the second thing, you mentioned in the bio, you know, the fact that we had a solid postseason. So there were all these rumors about TC throwing amazing batting practice to Barry Bonds, and he would get Barry going. So we win the NLCS, and we have a gap before the World Series, and TC goes, I'm going to come out and throw BP. I've never seen TC throw. TC comes out, and he's throwing 80 miles an hour. He is firing that thing in there. But it was as close to game-like scenario, and it locked me in. I was ready. That's why I had a good World Series for that. I mean, guys were stepping out of the cage like, nope, I'm not breaking my bats. I'm not doing that. TC was humping and throwing that thing up there. But it was great, and I see why Barry was able to do. I mean, it was strikes. It was velocity. It was intense. And I don't know how much BP Terry had been throwing all season long, but he was in shape in October and ready to go.
Well, I didn't throw as much as I wanted to throw, I can tell you that, because we had so many coaches. And, you know, in New York, you have so much other responsibilities. You know, you have so much media you got to take 2 minutes for. But, yeah, I'll tell you, Barry, I threw for about 4 years in a row, I threw all the batting practice Barry Bonds had. If he hit, I threw it. So we used to hit. Matter of fact, we had big bets and everything else. But, yeah, I used to love to throw it. But, you know, I think about Curtis. – You know, when we got the trade, obviously, I'm from Michigan. So, I mean, I'd heard all the Curtis Granderson stories from the guys with the Tigers because they, you know, I was a Tiger fan. So I couldn't wait. And I knew what he brought to the team. And, you know, and of course, we weren't Yankee Stadium anymore. We didn't have that little short right field fence that they did in Yankee Stadium. But you know what? He never changed. He never got out of his game. He just kept doing what he did best. But his presence in the locker room, you know, you don't hear a lot about the kind of leadership he is, but I'm going to tell you something. Without Curtis Granderson in 2015, Lucas Duda would not have been the player he was in 2015. You kept him. You got him, Curtis. You took him from this introverted guy to a fun-loving guy with a big smile on his face every day. And I'm thinking, what? And then I started finding out you were taping him and you were following him around. What was that about, that whole thing? But that, I'm telling you, that's the kind of stuff, John, when, you know, people think leaders, oh, they give speeches and stuff. That's not always true. You know, he just took this guy and made this guy just a better person to be around. It was a tremendous job with that. You got to tell me about that story.
I just wanted to have fun over there, but also know that we can work first and then, of course, still enjoy. It doesn't always have to be 100% serious. So I don't know if you all did it strategically or not, but my locker was next to Duda's. So once my locker was next to his, and I always tried to gravitate towards other left-handed bats. So I think Duda even asked me something about swinging left-handed, and that's how it started. So there was the spring training, we're talking, and then all of a sudden the season rolls, and Instagram had become this huge thing. And everyone's like, Duda, you got to get on social media. He's like, I don't want any part of it. Like, okay, we'll make a social media page for you, Duda. We follow Lucas Duda, and we're going to just hound him and get pictures and get videos and get all these crazy things about him. And he hated everything about it, but I think secretly he loved it because he knew he didn't have to do it. And he could just go out there and do it. So not only we had the kitchen staff, we had the trainers, we had everybody in was just trying to snap that photo. It was like we were the paparazzi trying to get him, but he went off. And I would just constantly keep messing with him. So we're in Dodger Stadium during the NLCS, and he's taking batting practice, and he hits a ball that goes to the top of the bleachers, and it breaks one of the signs, one of their billboard signs. Mind you, this is the middle of a playoff game. TC, I don't even know if you knew this happened. I run inside. I go to the office and get some Dodger letterhead, and I write up on it, say, hey, this is Dodgers ownership. You know, that sign cost us $5,000. We're going to put that straight from Mets payroll. And I put it on his chair. Now, this is this might have been game five. We go to Dodger Stadium for game five, right? That's how I wanted to keep it going. Like, the game is going to be pressure enough. How do we loosen it up? So I put that on his chair. He's reading. He's like, Grandy, is this true? I was like, I don't know. I mean, it says you have to pay it. So you might have to get that paid. Sure enough, you know, we finally joke, laugh. We go out, we win game five, and then we get ready to go to play the Cubs. So that's why I always try to just keep it loose and relaxed. And even one time we're in Atlanta. I don't know why, but remember when I bought the dodgeballs?
Yes.
We're playing team dodgeball in the visiting locker room before a game. I mean, you shouldn't have had DeGrom throwing a dodgeball or Wheeler throwing a dodgeball, but we were, and we're hitting guys. Guys are diving over couches and chairs, and then we go out and win. But I always wanted to keep the element of having the game fun, because it still is the same game that we started playing when we were little. There's just a lot more people watch us now, and the field's just a little bit bigger, but it still should be fun. And that was the way that I tried my best to lead. And I think a lot of guys were receptive to it.
I would say they were, yeah.
Absolutely. That's great stories there. Well, what a beloved team that is and always will be. And next year is going to be 10 years already, so time flies, I tell you. Curtis, you made it to the World Series with the Tigers and the Mets. What was it like to be a young player in 2006 in comparison to that veteran player who played for the Mets in the 2015 Fall Classic? And give us your favorite memory or moment of that 2015 season.
Well, you know, in 2006, you know, I'm excited just to make the team. I have another young, just all-star, who's amazing that he's still playing right now, Justin Verlander. He makes the team with me that year. So we're the young presence on that team, but we have just veteran stars, Kenny Rogers, Magliore Ordóñez, Pudge Rodriguez, Dimitri Young, and just they take you underneath their wing and just show you how to go about doing it. But you also watch. Okay, they're good for a reason. Let me see why they're so good. And you're getting a chance to watch. And they were receptive. Like, they didn't haze us. They didn't do anything crazy. I think that had just started to shift at that time, which was great. So we were able just to fit in, be ourselves, and enjoy. And we literally were a team with the 2006 Tigers, to the point where in 2007, the year after, we lose like the last week of the season, get eliminated from playoff competition in Chicago. So I was like, all right, you know, we're done, but obviously we're still going to finish up the season strong. So let's enjoy ourselves this evening. Now, mind you, when you have a team like that, the young players kind of do their thing. The veteran players do their thing. We all went out together that evening, had dinner, had a good time. And I remember Kenny Rogers coming up to me afterwards, goes, I had no idea where the hotel was. I'm trying to make it back to the hotel. It's 4 a.m. I don't remember where the hotel is. So he made it back. He wasn't pitching. But I say that because you very rarely get teams that are like that. Fast forward to 2015, we had that again. We had that team that we ate together. We hung out together. We did all these amazing things, from the dodgeball to chasing after Duda in the clubhouse, on the field. And when it was time to go to this different city, we did stuff. So for example, we're in Chicago. I host a camp here at UIC, University of Illinois Chicago, my alma mater. I invite the players to come out to the camp. I'm not expecting everybody to say yes. The players, the coaching staff, the trainers all came to support my camp. That's the type of team that we had in 2015 as well, which was very similar to the team and the chemistry we had in 2006, which was big keys to why I think we were so successful. That team literally became that, an entire team from top to bottom, whether you were a rookie like I was in 06 or you were a veteran like I was in 2015. Everybody had an important role and everybody was respected.
Thank you. One more and then I'll throw it back to Terry. You've been a leader on and off the field throughout your career. SNY's Andy Martino reported that prior to the 2022 season, Buck Showalter wanted you to be his bench coach, which you declined at the time. Can you see a time when you might want to put the uniform back on as a coach or a manager in the MLB?
The answer clear is right now, as I talk to you, is an absolute no. And I'm going to explain why. And it's actually because of Terry. This isn't a bad thing, but it happened with Terry and Dick Scott and Ricky Bonas. We're in Atlanta. I go get breakfast in the morning. We have a night game. I'm coming back to the hotel. It's probably 12:30. I'm getting in the hotel. TC and the rest of the staff are dressed just like you see now. They have their polos on. They're ready to go to the ballpark. So I see them. I ask, oh, are you going to get something to eat? They go, no, we're going to the ballpark. I get nervous. I thought the game time got bumped up. I said, is the game's at 7, right? They said, yeah, but we got to go. We got meetings. We got to lift. We got to do our reports. We got to do all this stuff. I said, right now? They go, yeah, this is what time we go. Then you fast forward. The game doesn't end until 11:30, and the last bus is an hour after that. So they're at the ballpark from 12:30 to 12:30 every day. And at that moment, I said, there's no way I can do that. That is way too long of a day. But I have such a great deal of respect for all the coaches and the managers I've ever had, because that's the type of stuff that they do. And they're just constantly there getting notes, getting prepared, getting the team situated, getting everybody just situated across the board, that it just takes time. And I'm like, I don't know if I can dedicate that much time, 162 games, plus the playoffs, plus spring training. I mean, you got to dedicate February 15th to October 15th every year. So TC, I don't know how you did it, but thank you, because it takes a certain person to do it. And in that moment, I was like, nope, I'm not going to do it.
Thank you. Back to you, TC.
Well, Curtis, you brought up, you know, you talked about, you know, dedication and things you do. I want to talk about your off the field things that you do, because it is off the charts. And I don't know how many people know about some of these things. I mean, I went to the camp that you had. John, he didn't bring up the fact that you still have the cupcake?
I still got the cake balls, yeah. So
yeah, they're good. We'd go to Chicago and he'd bring these cake balls in, and if you weren't one of the first 6-7 guys, you may not get one. They went so fast. But I want to know how the academy's going. Are you still running that in Chicago? I mean, can you tell the fans of what that consists of? Because it is an amazing feat that you do.
So at UIC, I helped build the stadium in 2014. And part of that, I wanted to be able to give the opportunity for the community of Chicagoland area, boys and girls, kids ages 8 to 18, an opportunity to practice, play, and train all year long. That includes outdoors and indoors. Because as you know, Chicago has very similar weather to New York. When you get to those winter months, you got to be inside. But the way the game has gone, training year-round has become more of just a regular type of thing that you have to have if you can afford to have indoor space. So with Chicago Baseball and Educational Academy, also called CBEA, we are one of three indoor facilities in Chicago that offers up the space for everybody. We have Major League infield on the inside, so it's where I practice and train in the offseason. Players like Jason Kipnis, TJ McFarland, Luke Gregerson, just to name a few, would also train there in the offseason. But it's the only one that offers us up for free to those kids in the community. So we have that going on. And plus, when the weather is great in the outside, in the summertime, we get them outside. And I argue we have the best view in all of baseball, because you have the Chicago skyline in our outfield right there. So we do those great things with CBEA. It's been going on now since 2016. So we're coming up on 10 years for that. And we're still moving and grooving. We actually have a Major League Wiffle Ball series going on July 27th. So proceeds from that are going to help benefit CBEA as well. So bring out the crazy moving, sliding and grooving balls and all that good stuff, and have a little event tied to that as well.
So Curtis, do you still have help the kids with school? There's educational stuff that they, when they come in?
Yeah. So the Curtis Granderson Foundation still gets involved with that. We've taken a couple shifts on a few of those things. So when we initially started it, I started the foundation in 2007 in Detroit, where the high school graduation rate was only at 50%. Both of my parents taught in the Chicago public school system. My sister currently and still teaches at the university level. And at the time, I was one of a handful of Major League Baseball players with a college degree. So we really focused a lot on education to get things going. We then added, Fighting Childhood Obesity with Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. So we got you active, we got you focused, but then we also realized those two are connected. But if you aren't properly nutritioned and have a meal and you're food insecure, meaning you don't know where your next meal is coming from, forget focusing in the classroom, forget moving around and staying active. So we've shifted a lot of it to fighting food insecurity, but all of it ties back into together, again, just trying to help you be the best you that you can be by making sure you're properly nutritioned, that you continue to stay active. And of course, education is an option for you.
So Curtis, tell me about the Baseball Alliance, their Major League Alliance. I know you were the president. Are you still the president of that? And yes. So how did that get started? Who started that?
So Sturva's the board chair for the Players Alliance, which was started in 2020. Three players, Dee Gordon, Cameron Maben, and Edwin Jackson, were the three founding members of that. Edwin Jackson still serves as a founding board member, and then CeCe Sabathia serves as our vice chair. So we started that in 2020, all about trying to take things that we had heard from the previous generations that we've had conversations about how do we provide more opportunities for Black ball players in this game. So players like Dave Winfield, Willie Horton, Mookie Wilson, just to name a few, we had had these conversations. We just couldn't collectively come together consistently because life was happening. Baseball was going on. Families were happening. People were in the playoffs. People weren't in the playoffs. But in 2020, everybody was sitting home. Everybody figured out how to do video chats like we're doing right now. So we're able to get everybody collectively together and bridge that gap and say, all right, let's push forward and keep this thing going. With partnership with Major League Baseball Players Association and Major League Baseball, we now have some things in place where we're going out to different communities across the U.S. where we know Black participation is there, but also areas of poverty, because poverty doesn't see color. So there's white individuals, there's Asian, there's Latino, there's Black, there's brown, there's everybody that is hoping that they can have an opportunity to play, but financially they're struggling. They don't have uniforms, they don't have fields, they don't have enough for coaches, they don't have enough to go to showcases, and we can come in and try to provide ways to be able to help in a number of different ways there. So truly excited for that. And we also do, during MLB All-Star, we do our Game Changers event where we honor and give flowers to those that helped pave the way for us in that major league city. So with the Texas Rangers, we honored Gary Matthews Jr., Fergie Jenkins, Prince Fielder from his time with the Rangers, Darren Oliver, Mark McLemore, Tony Beasley, and Marcus Semien, just to name a few. So it's just great that, you know, we get a chance to show the players from before, the legends, the Hall of Famers, those veterans. I'm now in that recently retired area. The current players, the all-stars, the ones that your kids and your grandkids are looking up to, and that next generation of player coming up. And that's what we're really trying to focus on, is that pipeline of talent and accessibility just to continue to keep you in the game for as long as you want to be in it.
Well, I will tell you, Curtis, that is an absolutely tremendous thing you're doing from your education camp to your grandkids to the Alliance. I mean, what you're giving back to people who are less fortunate than yourself is absolutely amazing. And that's what makes it such an honor to know you and to be around you to see this. And John, that's one of the reasons why he can't get back into managing and coaching. He's being pulled in so many different directions right now. He doesn't know, you know, it's probably hard for him every morning. He probably has to get up and look at that schedule of what I've got in today's, but he's the best, and I really appreciate it. And so, John, I know you've got some questions from some fans, so we'll go to those.
All right. Thank you, Terry. And, Curtis, it's been a pleasure. We do have some questions from the fans. Some of them have been answered, like our question from Jack Forrest from Instagram. I'm so pumped for this episode. I love Curtis. Can you ask Curtis about the Instagram account he made for Lucas Duda? That was hilarious. So we kind of covered that one.
Yep.
But anything else you want to expound on lightening Lucas Duda up? And did he eventually get to enjoy that Instagram account?
I don't know if he ever enjoyed it. I think he was happy. Remember when we traded Duda to the Rays, we actually traded the account as well.
Did you really?
So we traded the account to Sergio Romo. And after that point, we kind of lost it a little bit. I still had access to it for a little bit, but I tried to log in and my logins don't work. So I got to see if I can get back to it somehow. And I ran into Duda actually in Florida, West Palm Beach, actually, about 2 years ago. But he's doing well. He's out in California. He's going back to school. So he's doing a lot of great things as well. But, you know, it's just one of those friendships and bonds that was formed before the We Follow Lucas Duda page and still after, because he could have hated me for that. And I know he didn't love it, but we're still cool to this point.
Very cool. We do have a final question here from the fans. It comes from our X account, Starshot9 asks, how big of a WWE fan are you, and did you ever attend WrestleMania?
So very big, not as big now because I don't get a chance to watch it all the time like I used to. But I was very big. My grandmother got me big into WWF at the time because when my grandmother would come to visit, my dad would record the pay-per-views and then my grandma would babysit me. So we'd pop in that VHS of SummerSlam or Royal Rumble or WrestleMania and I would sit in front with my pillow and pretend to practice all the moves while she sat back and watched me. And that was her way of babysitting. And that's how it just became. So wrestlers like Junkyard Dog and Coco Beware and Rowdy Piper and Hogan and Macho Man and Andre the Giant, you know, that was my introduction to it early on. Then I was a part of the Attitude Era. So, you know, getting a chance to see the Monday Night Wars of Nitro versus Raw. So huge into that, into college side. And then pro baseball, unfortunately, because of the scheduling, we're playing Monday night. We're playing Sundays on pay-per-views and so on. But I did get a chance to attend WrestleMania in Detroit. And I tell everybody that it was the best sporting event I've ever been to. And they go, really? What? How? Why? I said, you had 70,000 people there. So I haven't been to very many events that have that many people. That's one. Two, everybody is into it and intense. They know the entrance musics. They know the finishing moves. They're all excited for it. The pyrotechnics are insane, plus the music. So you add all that. The event itself was crazy. And I think that was the one where former President Donald Trump was at that WrestleMania in Detroit. So my parents still have one of the ringside chairs that you can get if you were sitting there, which has Trump as a wrestler at that time on it. So just very iconic just to get a chance to see that. And that was 2008, I think it was, in Detroit. So I've always loved it. I've enjoyed it. I just, you know, don't get a chance to watch it nearly as much as I used to.
Yeah, that was WrestleMania 23, I think you were talking about, at Ford Field. And there was 83,000.
83.
That was crazy. Yep. And that was also the WrestleMania where Donald Trump shaved Vince McMahon's head in the middle of the ring in the Battle of the Billionaires. That was a crazy WrestleMania for sure. But thank you for that. And that was our fan questions. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, Curtis, I can't thank you enough for coming on. I know you're a busy guy and I can't wait to you have this put together. It's going to get out there. People are going to love it. You did a great job. And thanks again for coming on the show. And I hope to stay in touch and get to see you soon.
For sure. Thank you. Always good to see you. Enjoy Florida or Michigan, wherever you end up. At TC, it was great playing for you, and thank you so very much for having me.
You bet, pal. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. And Curtis, one other thing, I mean, before we go here today, can you tell everybody out there, if they want to make a donation to any of your foundations or nonprofits, tell them how they could reach you or those foundations?
So the easiest one right now, because we had so many things we talked about, is my nickname, The Grandy Man. So go to grandyman.com. You can check out everything there. We have highlights to take you to CBEA, to take you to the Players Alliance and the Curtis Granderson Foundation. So if you can't remember all the different names, just remember my nickname, search The Grandy Man, and I will pop up and you'll get a chance to see what we got going on.
There you go. Well, thank you very much. Again. Thanks,
thank you.
Well, Terry is advertised. Curtis Granderson. It was a fabulous segment. What a quality individual this man is.
Yeah. You know, John, as we said during the interview, you know, there are leaders and then there are people who just lead by example. And that's one of the things Curtis did. He loved to have fun. He loved to keep people positive. His positiveness that he brings. And I have seen, like he talked on the interview, I've seen this guy get booed bad. And the next day you would have thought he was 4-for-4 the night before. He was never changed. Every day he came in ready to play, played 160 games, you know, and those kind of guys, it's tough to get him out of the lineup. But what he does off the field to give back to the city of Chicago and the things he's done to help people, it's amazing. He's an amazing human being, and certainly we all should tip our hats to what he's done.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Well, Terry, now it's time for the Tunnel to Towers Amazing Hero of the Week. And born from the tragedy of 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation made a promise to ensure we never forget. Since then, it's been committed to supporting America's heroes and their families, heroes like fallen officer Sheldon Whiteman. Thanks to the generosity of friends like you, Tunnel to Towers paid off the mortgage on his family's home, relieving a financial burden and bringing stability to that family. The foundation helps Gold Star and falling first responder families, as well as our nation's most catastrophically injured heroes and homeless veterans. Join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good. America's heroes are counting on you. 95 cents of every dollar you give goes directly to its programs. Donate $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at T2T.org. That's T2T.org. Never forget 9/11 or the sacrifices our heroes have made. And now we pay tribute to the Tunnel to Towers amazing hero of the week, Sheldon Whiteman, a longtime deputy sheriff in Georgia. Country music artist Travis Tritt talks to his family about Sheldon right now.
Tell me a little bit about your husband.
His career was his ministry.
Mm-hmm.
He served the community.
He was so involved, and all his time was spent is either at work or at home with us doing something.
You know, he was just an all-round wonderful man, wonderful father. You can't ask for anything more than Sheldon Whiteman.
Devoted family man.
Very much so.
There's no greater gift than to lay down your life for your fellow man.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about what Tunnel to Towers has meant to you and your family?
Tunnel to Towers, they stepped in really, really early.
Yes.
Not too long after my husband went to glory.
Yes.
Tunnel to Towers, they reached out and provided strength for us. They provided love, and they stayed by our side. But the most important thing that they did that we hold dear to us is, you know, they paid off for our home. So our walls, and we look at our steps, we can see Dad coming down.
Yes.
You know, even sometimes in the living room, we can look at his favorite chair and see him laying there watching TV.
Yes.
Like, the home can be still beautiful. And we hold his memories within the home.
That's wonderful. And to be able to not have to worry about paying a mortgage.
Yes.
And being able to stay in the home that he obviously loved and that you all obviously love. That obviously means a lot.
It's just beautiful.
Join us in supporting our nation's heroes and their families now. It only takes $11 a month to make a positive impact. Go to T2T.org now.
And we'll have another T2T Amazing Hero on next week's show. Terry, as Howie Rose would say, put another episode in the books. We have some big news about next week's show. If you'd like, please share it with the fans.
Yes. Things have been going so good, and the Mets are playing so much better. We're all excited. So I reached out to Carlos Mendoza, the manager of the Mets, and he was willing to come on the show next week, and it should be a lot of fun. I hope they have a huge week, so we can have a lot of fun talking to him about how he feels in his first year managing the Mets and certainly getting them in a playoff situation.
Yeah, and that's also the trading deadline. So that should be a good one next week, Terry.
We're looking forward to it.
Yes, we are. You can follow Terry on X and Instagram at @TerryCollins_10. And for those of you on Facebook, follow Terry there at The Terry Collins Show. You can follow me on X and Instagram at John Arezzi. Make sure to subscribe now to The Terry Collins Show wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts and on our YouTube channel. Until next time, this is John Arezzi for Terry Collins. Have a great week, everyone.